From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We've met for almost 2 hours to tell the Justice Department that we cannot accept living under a verdict that says that any police under any imagined fear has the right to shoot at us and then shoot at us 41 times.
Thousands head to Washington, D.C. to demand of the Justice Department federal charges be brought against the four officers who killed Amadou Diallo. We'll go to Los Angeles, where similar demands are being made in the Diallo case as well as another. Then we'll look at whether U.S. elections are free and fair from the perspective of Mexican observers. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The young African-American man killed by police just 2 nights ago in the Bronx, just 3 blocks from the killing of Amadou Diallo, furor around it continues. The weeping mother of Malcolm Ferguson accused police officers yesterday of executing her son because he was slapping them with a $5 million police brutality suit. Juanita Young's accusations allege that Malcolm Ferguson was slain because he launched the suit accusing the police of breaking his hand when they handcuffed him during a March 9, 1999 marijuana arrest. His lawyer, Andrew Miller, said that the police held him for 2 days before he could see a doctor.
Well, the doctors essentially took one look at it and operated him on practically that evening. It was a very brutal break and, in my opinion, intentional.
The slain man's lawyer, Andrew Miller, says that Malcolm Ferguson had filed a legal notice that he intended to sue the New York Police Department for $5 million 9 months ago and planned to submit the full suit soon. And just after that protest, the protest continued to gain steam yesterday evening in the Bronx as Malcolm Ferguson's death inspired protest. And just as those protests were happening in the Bronx, again just 3 blocks from Amadou Diallo's house, thousands gathered in front of the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., demanding that federal prosecutors take on the Amadou Diallo case and bring civil rights charges against the 4 white police officers who killed Amadou Diallo. Among those who met with the number 2 man in the Justice Department, Eric Holder, were Congressmember Charles Rangel, Harlem Congressmember, Democrat, as well as the Reverend Al Sharpton. This is Rangel.
They have monitored the trial of Amadou Diallo, and they have reached a conclusion, as I have, that a formal investigation should take place. That means that something sounds like it's wrong and that they need evidence to prove it.
We met for almost 2 hours,
Reverend Sharpton,
to tell the Justice Department that we cannot accept living under a verdict that says that any police under any imagined fear has the right to shoot at us and then shoot at us 41 times.
And the second man in the Justice Department, Eric Holder, talked to reporters just before he had his meeting with Reverend Al Sharpton, Charles Rangel, and others.
These are difficult cases to prosecute. The standard that we have to meet on the federal side is a high one. But we will look at the case. We have been involved in the matter since shortly after the shooting. We had people or a person at the trial to monitor the trial as it was proceeding. So we will now have our civil rights division in conjunction with our U.S. attorney in Manhattan, one of our best U.S. attorneys, Mary Jo White, apply their skills to look at the evidence and see whether or not federal involvement is appropriate.
Number 2 man in the Justice Department, Eric Holder. And we're going to go to more on that story in just a minute. We'll be going out to Los Angeles, where activists will be meeting with the Justice Department as well, calling for an investigation into the Diallo case as well as others. In international news, a Chilean Air Force plane believed to be carrying former dictator Augusto Pinochet landed at Santiago's International Airport. Pinochet left Britain yesterday after that nation's top law enforcement official ruled that the 84-year-old former dictator was physically and mentally unfit to stand trial on charges of human rights abuses. Relatives of the victims of Pinochet's 1973 to 1990 regime are disappointed at Britain's decision. They say they'll try to have him prosecuted in Chile. As a Chilean senator, Pinochet enjoys immunity from prosecution, but human rights lawyers have requested that his immunity be lifted. One of the lawyers predicts a court ruling in about a month. Chilean law doesn't exempt sick people from trial unless they're certified as deeply mad.
You can't ask Colin Roach if him really shoot himself. And you can't ask Vincent Graham if he's him stab himself. But you can ask the commissioner about the license to kill. Ask Sir Paul Condon about the license to kill. You can't ask the Douglas them about the new style baton. And you can't ask Tony Hassan about him dead by neglect. You can't ask Marlon Downs if him have any regret. And you can't ask El Gamal about the mystery of him dead. But you can ask Dame Barbara about the license to kill. Ask the DPP about the license to kill. You can't ask Ibrahim about the CS gas attack. You can't ask Mrs. Jarrett how she get her heart attack. You can't ask Oliver Price about the grip round his neck. And you can't ask Steve Boyce about him dead by neglect. But you can ask the PCA about the license to kill. Ask the ACPO about the license to kill. If you ask Maggie Thatcher about the license to kill. And you can ask John Major about the license to kill. If you ask Michael Howard about the license to kill. And you can ask Jack Straw about the rule of law. If you ask Tony Blair.
Lytton Kwesi Johnson, License for Kill, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Oh, good day, Amy, and to our listeners all around the country.
It's great to see you, and in a few minutes we're going to do part two of the interview with you on the growing Latino voting power in this country, but not just talk about Latinos in the United States as we move into the Super Tuesday primary next week, into states that have some of the largest Latino voting populations, but also to go back in time to look at why Latinos came to this country and to look at U.S. foreign policies in the countries that they were fleeing from. But before we do that, a few comments as well as a look at this growing movement against anti-police brutality. This is on a lighter note, and it's from the Wall Street Journal. The name of a world leader has gotten George W. Bush Jr. into trouble again. After a rally in Canton, Michigan last week, a man posing as a Canadian television reporter told Mr. Bush that Canadian Prime Minister Jean Poutine had endorsed him as, quote, the man to lead the free world into the 21st century. Mr. Bush beamed. "I'm honored," he said. "I appreciate his strong statement. He understands our belief in free trade," the aspiring president added. "He understates want to ensure our relationship with our most important neighbor to the north of us, Canadians, is strong. We will work closely together." Unfortunately for Mr. Bush, Canada's prime minister is Jean Chrétien, not Poutine. Poutine is a French-Canadian concoction of French fries and cheese curds smothered in gravy that is much beloved in Quebec. The man posing as a journalist was Canadian comedian Rick Mercer, whose segment on a satirical weekly TV show often lampoons American ignorance of Canadian matters. He once had the governor of Arkansas congratulate Canada on building a national igloo to protect its parliament building. The show broadcast Mr. Bush's reply earlier this week. "We got him hook, line, and sinker," said Jeff Dionne. Calls to Bush's spokesperson Ari Fleischer in Austin, Texas, weren't returned.
Well, Bush has had problems before on some foreign policy questions.
That's right. And so he now has the endorsement of French fries and cheese curds. But there are very serious issues that we have to deal with. And it's important, I think, that this is also taking place in election year because it forces elected officials to be accountable to people in a way that they are usually not. I mean, you not only have politicians who want to be president, people like Bill Bradley, who is not in office right now, but you have politicians who are in office and don't just make promises but can do something now, like Vice President Al Gore. Well, today we're going to continue the look at the Amadou Diallo case, but it is not just a case that is causing furor in New York. Thousands of people went down to Washington yesterday and demanded of Eric Holder, number two man in the Justice Department, that federal charges be brought against the four police officers. Now we understand that today a group of people are going to be challenging the Justice Department as well, but this time in Los Angeles. And we're joined right now by Earl Afari Hutchison, who is the director of National Alliance for Positive Action, who is pressing for prosecution by the Justice Department, not only in the Amadou Diallo shooting, but also in another case in Los Angeles, the Margaret Laverne Mitchell case. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Earl Afari Hutchison.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Amy and Juan.
Well, tell us about the Margaret Laverne Mitchell case and why you felt it necessary now to go to the Justice Department.
Well, actually, this is our third meeting with the Justice Department. Margaret Laverne Mitchell shooting by an LAPD officer occurred last May, so it's now almost 8-9 months old. Essentially, she was a middle-aged, homeless, emotionally disturbed African-American woman that lived on the streets in Los Angeles, central section of L.A., and the altercation in which she lost her life occurred over a shopping cart. Apparently, the LAPD got it in their mind, following the New York model, that they were going to do a quality control number in the city, and that meant that pandering, loitering, hanging around on corners, and even pushing shopping carts down the street, which literally thousands of people do, that they were going to put a stop to that. So they accosted her, and the altercation occurred. The officer shot her. He claimed at the time that she lunged at him with a screwdriver. Well, there were witnesses that came forth independent. They had no access to grind whatsoever. And essentially they disputed the police version. They said they never saw a screwdriver. They never saw this little frail 104-pound woman lunge at these two officers. So essentially, this went on. There were a number of demonstrations. There were a number of protests, candlelight vigils, walks, marches, protesting the shooting and other shootings in the city. She wasn't the only one. But as a result of that, an interesting thing happened. We began meeting with the Justice Department because they responded right away and said that they were going to essentially conduct their usual probe and investigation and so forth, although they made it clear it was going to take many, many months. Now, in the meantime, we also went to the police commission, which supposedly is the civilian oversight agency over the operations and policies and procedures of the police department, LAPD. Now, the police commission, never in the history of this police commission going back 50 years, never had they ruled or overruled a chief when he has ruled that a shooting is in policy, and almost always, in 99% of the cases, the police chief always rules that any shooting, no matter what the circumstances, no matter how outrageous, that they're always in policy. Well, what happened as a result of community pressure, result of the meetings, and result of just keeping the screws on and keeping the heat on, and also bringing those witnesses forth, the inspector general and the police commission finally showed some guts for a change, overruled Police Chief Parks and said the shooting was out of policy. In other words, it was murder. So what happened is that has given us even more ammunition. Now, that happened about a month ago. That's given us more ammunition to go back to the Justice Department once again to essentially say, okay, you've got this. The coroner has ruled the shooting of Margaret Laverne Mitchell a homicide officially. You've got the police commission and the inspector general's report ruling it out of policy. We know that L.A. County District Attorney Gil Garcetti has already made it clear he's not going to do anything. He's not going to prosecute the officer involved in the shooting. So really the ball is in your court. What are you going to do about it? You made us a lot of promises 8 months ago that you were going to take this case all the way. And if there were, in fact, clear violations there, essentially you were going to press a civil rights case against this officer. So now it's time to show and tell.
Well, Earl, you've also raising the Amadou Diallo case. How closely was the Diallo case watched on Court TV or followed by people in the Los Angeles area?
You know, Juan, I have to be honest with you. My sense, and again, this is not scientific, it's just impressions and anecdotal and just talking with other people, not very well watched, not very well followed. There were a few people, the kind of veteran trial watchers and certainly some political activists that paid attention to it. You know, even myself, I have to confess, you know, I was in and out with it. But the sense I got was toward the end, just talking with people, that the feedback I got, and from my sense at the end following the trial, that the prosecutor essentially was dumping the case, and that the judge, if there was any doubt about it, put the nail in the coffin with this ridiculous four-hour instruction, which practically commanded the jurors, even if they had an independent thought, that jury practically commanded them to acquit the officers. So I knew that at that point in time, that the fix was in, the deal was in, that the four officers were going to walk. And I think that was a sense from people that were following it toward the end.
So you're going to be holding a news conference today in front of the federal building in downtown Los Angeles?
Yes.
And will you be going inside?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, we're going to have a very extensive meeting, and we are told that the U.S. attorney, Alejandro Mayorkas, in this area, will present us at that time with a bill of goods. By that I mean essentially what progress, if any, the FBI has made. He assigned seven officers to the investigation, what they found, what the determination is, and apparently there's going to be another U.S. assistant attorney there that's been monitoring the case. And essentially, if there is a prosecution, she would have to make the recommendation based on testimony from the witnesses and the evidence and whatever the FBI has gathered as a result of their probe.
And Earl Afari Hutchison, before we leave you, the latest in the Ramparts scandal, the going to the web and checking for us, the Los Angeles Times, we're looking at the case, the continued investigation of the INS. The INS and the relationship with the Los Angeles Police Department, that when the LAPD couldn't come up with cases against gang members, what they did instead was deal with the INS and get INS agents to arrest them and have them deported.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, that was a result of some testimony from officers, Perez and some of the others, but this has been going on for quite a while. The LAPD denies it. The district attorney denies there's any collusion there. But I have to tell you, this has been something that has been documented going back five or six years. There were other divisions, the 77th Street Station, which is located in an area with a heavy Latino and particularly immigrant population. Also, the Newton Street Station, the same thing, heavily Latino immigrant population. And essentially, complaints have been lodged over the years about this cozy sweetheart relationship between the LAPD and the Immigration and Naturalization Service. So, yes, it came out with Ramparts, but I have to tell you, this is something that's been ongoing, and these charges have been made repeatedly in the past. And as you could probably guess, they've also been repeatedly ignored in the past.
Do you feel that there is a sea change going on right now in terms of dealing with police brutality, not only in Los Angeles, but around the country? Or do you think that this is going to be a wave that's going to be put out?
Well, I'd like to say, and like to think anyway, that there is a sea change. But let me just say, in L.A., I think here's the problem, and probably it's the same in other cities too. Remember, it's a two-tiered system. You have the activists, you have the politically and socially conscious people who have been aware of these problems for, eons of time, and that are in the streets, that are doing things with various activities, certainly to highlight the problem and dramatize the problem and keep the pressure on. The problem is coming in is that you've got these elected officials. They're literally near paralysis. They won't do anything. They won't say anything except go to the barricades and go to the wall defending the police. Even in L.A., for example, the city council, they've been pounding on the city council. They've been pounding on the police commission. Do something. Say something. They've been pounding on the L.A. County Board of Supervisors. Speak out. This is the time to do it. There's a wedge. There's an opening. What has happened here, even as late as 2 days ago, after Bernard Parks released his Board of Inquiry report, which was a pretty scathing indictment of his own department, even then, by an 8-3 vote, the L.A. City Council still refused to adhere to a request that has been on the board for many, many weeks now to have an independent civilian monitoring agency or commission come in to see that these recommendations for reform and change are implemented. If not, it's just another report, like, dozens of reports that will be out there, get a little publicity for a while, and then be swept into the dustbin. So the problem is these do-nothing, moribund, near-paralysis elected officials that are scared to death and gutless to take a position, about police misconduct and abuse. And until you can shake them, until the voters really wake up and the general public not only moves from disgust, passive disgust, to active outrage, then you're not going to have any change.
Well, Earl O'Farrell Hutchinson, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Director of National Alliance for Positive Action will be outside the federal building in downtown Los Angeles today, as well as inside, meeting with Justice Department officials over the Giallo killings, as well as the case of Margaret Laverne Mitchell. We thank you for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to be talking to an independent monitor who's come to the United States from Mexico to look at whether our elections are free and fair. And then we're going back in time with Juan Gonzalez to look at Latinos in the United States, how they came here, and their power today as we are in these year 2000 federal elections. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. You must have heard the story in the last few days about the little boy, 6 years old, who killed the little girl, 6 years old, in Flint, Michigan. An incredible story. Well, looking at the New York Daily News today, it says he didn't pull the trigger, but authorities say a 19-year-old man should go to jail for letting a little boy get hold of the pistol he used this week to kill a 6-year-old classmate. Jamel James, who police say left a handgun under blankets on his bed, was arraigned in a charge of involuntary manslaughter, which carries a maximum sentence of 15 years in prison. The boy, who lived in the same house as Jamel, found the gun on Tuesday, took it to the Theo Buell Elementary School, and fatally shot classmate Kayla Rolland. Well, Michael Moore, the filmmaker and media critic, wrote a very interesting piece that has been floating around the web. You know that Michael comes from Flint, Michigan, and was editor of the Flint Voice for many, many years, and did the film Roger and Me about going after Roger Smith, the CEO of General Motors. This is a letter that he wrote just after the shooting. He says, "Dear friends, I tried to write this letter to you last night, but the level of sadness in me would not allow me to sit at this keyboard and compose these words. How much more can my hometown take? How much more do the people we love have to suffer? Isn't it enough that tens of thousands of lives in Flint have been wrecked, destroyed by the greed of General Motors? Isn't it enough that my wife and I and tens of thousands of others who love our home, love it more than any of you will ever know, have had to leave Flint in the past 20 years to find work far from family and friends? Isn't it enough that Flint suffers the highest or near highest per capita rates of murder, rape, and theft in the nation? I thought there was nothing else left for Flint to go through. Like Job, it seemed that every imaginable sorrow had been visited upon its people. I guess I was wrong. I look up at the TV and a helicopter is hovering over a school while the words Buell Elementary flash on the screen. Buell? At the end of The Big One, the movie that Michael did, he says, when I twisted Nike chairman Phil Knight's arm to match my $10,000 contribution to the kids of Flint, that $20,000 went to Buell Elementary. Buell Elementary, where the shooting took place, is in the Flint Beecher School District, the poorest school district in Genesee County, Michigan, and perhaps the poorest in the entire state. 82% of its children, according to the federal government, live below the official poverty level, meaning the number of kids in total poverty is even higher. Beecher is Flint's dump. It is where you go when you have nothing left to your name. 60% black, 40% white. No municipality in Genesee County wants to govern Beecher, so it exists as a no man's land on the northern city limits of Flint. It covers a small portion of two different townships, one of which is where my wife Kathleen is from. But folks, when you hear the word township used in the case of Beecher, those of us from Flint mean it in the way the word was used in South Africa. Buell Elementary in the Flint Beecher School District has a Flint address and a Flint phone number, but the black officials from Flint on the news yesterday tried to point out that this school really isn't in Flint. It's amazing how deep oppression takes its roots when even black leaders find themselves in bed with General Motors and, like Peter in the Garden of Gethsemane, repeatedly deny that people of their own race have anything to do with them. And it goes on from there. A letter from Michael Moore after he heard about the shooting by a six-year-old of a six-year-old in Flint, Michigan. Well, we are going to turn right now to another story. And it is, yes, a national story, and that is the election 2000. We're used to hearing about U.S. officials and citizens going off to other countries to investigate whether elections are free and fair. Well, today we're going to talk to someone who has come to the United States to see whether the Mexican elections are free and fair. For the first time ever.
You mean the U.S. elections?
Whether the U.S. elections are free and fair. For the first time ever, prominent international civil society members are coming to the United States to investigate. This is unprecedented, election observation mission, beginning this week before the California primary and then continuing later this fall during the general election. The presence of foreign election observers promises to foster new discussions about American democracy and to provide new unbiased and nonpartisan insights on the central debates about U.S. democracy. This is a group that is sponsored by the San Francisco-based group Global Exchange. And we're joined right now by one of the delegation members. He's Alberto Olvera, chief researcher at the Institute of Social History at the University of Veracruz. Since 96, he's been on the National Coordinating Committee of Alianza Cívica and is a member of the leadership of Alianza Cívica of Veracruz.
Well, Alberto Olvera, welcome to Democracy Now! I'd like to start off by asking you, what made you want to come here to observe the United States elections? Of course, here in the United States, the people are told that we've got the freest and fairest elections in the world. Why would anybody want to observe ours?
Well, I think that we have two main reasons to do this. One of these is that we think that we as professional observers for a long time now in Mexico have some experience in these kind of issues, and we are able to see the problems that electoral systems have. We think that all democracies have problems all around the world, and the American one is not an exception. So we can help in some way to detect these problems. On the other hand, we are still building our own democracy in Mexico. This is an incomplete process, and we think that we can learn from you in several ways, from both the problems or the obstacles and the advantages of your system. So we are here in this double process of learning and criticizing in a constructive way.
So tell us what you've done so far.
Well, we've been in San Francisco for one day. We spent the day having interviews with political activists, with people on the streets. We've been very active looking at an exchange of ideas with people from all the political spectrum. We have a meeting with representatives of the third parties, and something very interesting to us, because we didn't know that there were more national parties besides the Democratic and Republican parties. So we are learning all the problems third parties have in order to get some public attention, both in legal and organizational terms. And certainly, so far, we are beginning to understand the problems of representative democracy here.
Well, of course, when it comes to third parties, Mexico is far more advanced than the United States because third parties have had a lot of difficulty here, even sometimes getting on the ballot in many states. So that this will be an important observation on your part to be able to see and to document what some of the obstacles are to their access to the voters. Now, are you going to be also looking particularly at how the Latino population in the United States exercises the voting franchise, or are you going to be doing a general look at all populations throughout the country?
Well, yes, our purpose is more general, but of course we are very much interested in understanding the specific problems of the Latino population. But indeed, first of all, we want to understand the problem, the general problem. For example, we have in Mexico a system that is half based in proportional representation, and of course this helps small parties to get a starting point in the political system. So it was very surprising for us to see that it's very difficult here without this specific system to have a chance of getting public attention, for example. The issue of soft money, for example, that you all well know very well, is also an issue in Mexico, but however, we have there a system of public financing, so this is a different issue. We have the problem of authoritarian system still resisting all the citizen efforts of being accountable to the citizenry in matters of illegal financing of the official party. But here the problem is different, is the open and profound intervention of private interest in the political system. So this is something that we Mexicans are trying to avoid through the system of public financing. Well, issues like this are something that is of great interest to us, and we are expecting to deliver a kind of analysis of this system, something that for sure most of you know very well. And however, we want to contrast, to compare these two systems, because maybe through this kind of exercise we will be able to better understand the problems you have here.
Can you explain your group? Can you explain what Alianza Cívica is, since a number of the observers that you're with are from there?
Yes. Alianza Cívica is a national social movement. We were born in the 1994 elections. Since 1990, there were several regional and state efforts in Mexico in order to force the political system to abide by the law, to respect electoral results. We look for a way of exerting pressure of the political system, and we decided that observing the elections, meaning being present the day of the election and the ballots, will be a way of a symbolic way of showing our distrust of the workings of the system. So we went through a process of learning that allows us to define a system of observation that in the 1994 elections allowed us to watch over the entire electoral process since the beginning. So in this year, we had the participation of over 40,000 citizens all around the country, and we were able to demonstrate that the electoral system have a lot of problems, that a lot of holes that allowed the government to to intervene and to force in some way the decision of the citizens in terms of for whom or how to vote. For example, we demonstrated that there was a terrible problem in terms of clientelism, or what we call the buying of votes, and that could decide the electoral results in some ways. Since then, since 1994, we have had a lot of electoral reforms, both at federal and state level. Some of these reforms have helped a lot in terms of getting rid of the state intervention in the electoral process. Thanks to this social movement, the Federal Electoral Institute was created or transformed in such a way that now this institute is an independent body. The organization of elections in Mexico now is a process carried out by an independent body whose main directors are citizens without a political party participation.
Alberto Olvera, I'd like to ask you, in terms of, I know that there's been talk that in the upcoming national elections in Mexico, I think it's this summer, isn't it, the national elections there,
July.
That Mexican nationals in the United States will be able to vote for the first time. Is that going to create any more problems in terms of being able? I'm sure it's going to create more logistical problems to be able to tally the vote. But do you envision any new problems in terms of possible fraudulent voting as a result of that?
Actually, Mexicans will not be able to vote. Mexicans who live here in the United States, the legal principle of Mexicans living in the United States being able to vote is already accepted and included in the law. However, we have not defined the ways to do that. So in this election, this is not going to happen. Maybe in the following elections, it will be possible to do it. So for this election particularly, we will not have that chance. In the next future, it will be a very interesting process to see what happened, because, as you know, more and more Mexicans are coming to the United States, and so maybe in a moment, in the near future, we will have up to 10% of the Mexican citizens being able of voting living here. So that will force political leaders to campaign in the United States for the Mexican vote. So that will be a very interesting process, and indeed will change completely the Mexican political panorama.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Alberto Olvera, for joining us, chief researcher at the Institute of Social History at the University of Veracruz. He is here in the United States in California to observe the U.S. elections and the primary system, issuing a report on whether our elections are free and fair. And it is not only this group from Mexico that's the first group that's going to be doing this, but under the auspices of Global Exchange in San Francisco, there'll be groups that are going around the country and looking at how these elections are carried out. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And before we move on to our next segment, I just wanted to report on the continuing anti-sweatshop movement around the country, as well as the living wage campaign and how students are getting involved. We got this press release from Harvard students. Yesterday, they disrupted morning activities at the office of the Harvard president, Neil Rudenstein. Harvard University administrators, according to the students, are ignorant of their employees' need for a living wage. Currently, college students across the country are organizing protest in response to their university's disregard for workers' rights. This past Monday, Johns Hopkins University Student Labor Action Committee began its occupation of an administration building, demanding a living wage for Johns Hopkins employees. As part of this national movement for workers' rights, members of Harvard University's Progressive Student Labor Movement are educating the Harvard administration about the City of Cambridge's living wage ordinance. Students conducted a roving teach-in in which they travel to key administration offices, presenting demands and worker accounts that attest to the need for immediate implementation of a living wage. It appears that the city of Cambridge, Massachusetts, did pass a living wage ordinance that recommended Cambridge workers be paid a minimum of $10 per hour. Since before the passage of the ordinance, the Harvard Progressive students, along with prominent city leaders and over 1,000 Harvard students, had been urging Harvard to comply with Cambridge's standards for employment. The administration, however, has remained aloof to the principles they charge expressed in the living wage ordinance, and so students there and around the country are continuing to pressure universities to adopt living wage and recognize workers' rights. And in the last few weeks, we've reported also on the anti-sweatshop campaigns of students at the University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan, as well as University of Pennsylvania, and we'll continue to do that. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with Juan Gonzalez in just a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. George Bush and Al Gore, their eyes on their party's presidential nominations, campaigned hard as a multi-state poll today found them both headed for crushing Super Tuesday victories. The poll was conducted by John Zogby. It suggests that the battles for both the Republican and Democratic nominations may effectively end next Tuesday, setting the stage for a presidential election between Vice President Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush. The poll found Bush leading McCain in 7 of the 8 states surveyed, including California, New York, and Ohio, the 3 biggest prizes. It also found Bush had a chance of narrowly defeating McCain in the open ballot in California, as well as thrashing him among Republicans. Well, on Wednesday, we started a conversation with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now!, but also columnist with the New York Daily News and author of a new book on Latinos in the United States about the growing Latino voting power here. Juan's book is called Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America, looking at how people came to the United States and specifically arguing that massive Latino immigration is the inevitable consequence of our nation's age-old policy of domination toward Latin America. We talked about, Juan, voting blocks in New York and California on Wednesday, but I wanted to go deeper back into history about how Latinos came here. In your book, Harvest of Empire, you start off by talking about roots. You start off actually centuries ago talking about the colonization of Latin America.
Yeah, well, I have an initial chapter basically that deals with both the colonization of North America and Latin America and what was different about the Anglo-Saxon colonial experience versus the Spanish colonial experience, both in terms of the kinds of native societies upon which the settlers implanted their own settler societies, as well as the Africans that were brought and enslaved in both major colonial areas, and sort of like how the societies developed, and that's basically sort of trying to get into what are the characteristics of the Anglo-Saxon sort of experience in the Western Hemisphere versus the Latin American experience, sort of, I guess, in the womb, as I refer to it. But then in the I go on to talk a little bit about the territorial expansion of the United States, because once you get past the 13 colonies and then the Louisiana Purchase, that much of the subsequent territorial expansion of the United States occurred over lands that were already populated by people of Hispanic descent or mestizo or mixed race descent throughout the Southwest and Florida, and basically how the territorial expansion of the United States was from that point on sort of predicated on its ability to conquer its Latin American neighbors. And then beyond that, after the Spanish-American War, which was, I guess, the final grabbing of actual territory by the United States, what happened in the early 20th century to sort of lay the basis for what is today this enormous Latino presence in the country. And I think in one of the chapters, if I can find the spot, this is sort of like the thesis of a lot of the book, but then I go into detail in each of the different Latino groups. And I say, as we shall see, a series of military occupations early in the century. This is U.S. occupations of Latin America, sometimes brief, sometimes lasting decades, but always for the most spurious of reasons, allowed U.S. banks and corporations to gain control over key industries in every country. Latin American ventures sprang up on Wall Street overnight as sugar, fruit, railroad, mining, gas, and electric company executives raced south on the heels of the Marines. Thanks to the aid of pliant local elites and of U.S. diplomats or military commanders, who often ended up as partners or managers of the new firms, the newcomers quickly corralled lucrative concessions while the host countries fell deeper into debt and dependence. Whenever conflict erupted with a recalcitrant nationalist leader, the foreign company simply called on Washington to intervene. The pretext was usually saving U.S. citizens or preventing anarchy near our borders. To justify those interventions, our diplomats told people back home the Latin Americans were incapable of a responsible government. Journalists, novelists, and film producers reinforced that message. They fashioned and perpetuated the image of El Jefe, the swarthy, ruthless dictator with slick black hair, scarcely literate broken English accent, dark sunglasses, and sadistic personality, who ruled by fiat over a corrupt banana republic. Yet even as they propagated that image, our bankers and politicians kept peddling unsound loans at usurious rates to those very dictators. Critical details of how those dictators rose to power and terrorized their people with Washington's help, or how their regimes provided a friendly business climate for North American firms, remain hidden deep in diplomatic correspondences. As U.S.-owned plantations spread rapidly into Mexico, Cuba, Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Honduras, and Guatemala, millions of peasants were forced from their lands. Some were even displaced from their native countries when some of these same firms initiated cross-border labor recruitment efforts to meet their shifting labor needs of their far-flung subsidiaries. At first, the migratory labor stream flowed largely between the subject countries. West Indians, for instance, were recruited to build the Panama Canal, Haitians to cut sugar in the Dominican Republic, Puerto Ricans for the cane fields of Hawaii. But beginning with World War II, which shut down the supply of European labor, North American industrialists initiated massive contracting of Latin Americans for the domestic labor front. Thus began a migration process whose long-term results would transform 20th century America. And then I try to go through country to country in the Caribbean rim, showing exactly what were the firms that went down there, how they recruited their workers, where they took them from, and how the different Latino communities began to develop throughout, starting in early 20th century, but then especially after World War II, because really the mushrooming Latino presence in the country in terms of qualitative numbers has occurred since World War II.
Who was Juan Seguin?
Well, Juan Seguin was a rich landowner in South Texas, actually around the San Antonio area. His family had been in the South Texas area since the 1700s, a very prominent family in San Antonio. And actually, Seguin was a Federalist at the time. This is when Texas was still part of Mexico. And he actually fought with Davy Crockett and Sam Houston and all of the other Anglo-Texans who had settled in Texas in the Texas War of Independence against General Santana, who was then the leader of the Mexican government, because as a Federalist as opposed to a Centralist, he wanted to have more autonomy for Texas. Actually, Seguin escaped the massacre at the Alamo because he was sent out with a message to Sam Houston and so therefore was not killed when General Santana's troops surrounded and executed most of the Americans who fought at the Alamo. He then later became a mayor of San Antonio. He was elected a senator of the Texas Republic, but within a few years, he realized that the Anglos with whom he had fought for greater autonomy and independence for Texas did not care about any of the Mexicans who were living on the land. And so he was eventually chased in 1842. He was chased at gunpoint by illegal squatters, Anglo squatters who had come into Texas. His land was taken from him. He was chased from San Antonio, even though he was the mayor at the time, and had to flee to Mexico to survive. Juan Seguin became the last Mexican mayor of San Antonio until Henry Cisneros was elected 150 years later, in 1982, the mayor of San Antonio. And Seguin is sort of – I sort of use Seguin as a symbol of the patrimony of Latinos in politics in the United States that is a somewhat different patrimony from the one that we are accustomed to thinking of in terms of the founding fathers, because he represents a continued presence of Latinos in some sections of the United States long before those sections became American territory. And points to why, for instance, when you go throughout South Texas, and I always thought whenever I speak, I always recommend anyone who wants to get a fuller sense of the United States of America needs to go to South Texas. Because South Texas, once you get below San Antonio and you head down into towns like Corpus Christi and Brownsville and McAllen and Eagle Pass and the whole border area of South Texas is a territory of the United States, a huge territory, larger than either the states of Connecticut and New Jersey combined, that has always been 80 to 90% Mexican, has always spoken Spanish, and has remained virtually unchanged except for its economic development, but its population has remained virtually unchanged since before it came into the United States.
And how do you see that playing into national politics today? We have a candidate for President, George W. Bush, who's the governor of Texas, who is continually touted as a Republican who has large Latino support in his state.
I think that, the problem is no politician in Texas can get very far without attempting to build Latino support. I mean, you've got the reality that 25% of the Texas's population is Latino. And the entire southern half of the state once you get below San Antonio, is overwhelmingly Latino. So you find many politicians. It used to be Democrats, Lyndon Johnson, Lloyd Benson. All of them had huge following among Mexican Americans because of the old Jim Wells machine, the Democratic Party machine in South Texas. But increasingly, the modern Republicans of Texas have realized that you cannot really succeed in Texas for long as a politician, especially statewide, unless you make incursions into the Latino vote. That's something that is increasingly seen now in California. And, of course, Texas and California being the states, the big states with the largest Latino population, both 25 to 30%, the reality is that they are the future of the rest of the country. And so Bush just saw it sooner than a lot of other Republican politicians. And so he has made a concerted effort to try to reach out to the Latino community. But so many of his policies, of course, run contrary to the interests of that community, that I think in the long term that he's not really looking to get a majority vote. He's just looking to get a substantial minority vote.
Juan, as we just have a few minutes, and then you're headed to San Francisco on Monday, and you'll be in San Antonio on Tuesday, Houston on Wednesday. We'll be talking to you in these different places. Of course, the Super Tuesday primary Tuesday, California, New York, and other states, and the following Tuesday, March 14th, in Texas and Florida. You also weave into the story your own family and the examples of that as Latinos in the United States. Of course, you're Puerto Rican.
I have several chapters on different nationalities, and every chapter I sort of single in on one particular family or group of individuals to sort of tell the migration story through the experiences of those individuals. And in the Puerto Rican section, I figured, hey, may as well use my own family because it is sort of a paradigm for what happened in the Latino in the Puerto Rican migration experience, because my parents came here right after World War II, and when the largest group of Puerto Ricans came. So I attempt to tell the story of the Puerto Rican migration through that of my own family, and the because what I try to do is show how each group built its own communities, its own institutions, what cities the migrants went to, what hostility they encountered, how they overcame it. And so I attempt to do that in terms of Puerto Ricans in New York City.
You talk about Cubans, Puerto Ricans, the largest groups that came into the United States. Now, of course, Puerto Rico is a part of the United States, but does your family see when they come to the mainland as coming to another country?
That's the interesting part about the Puerto Rican experience, and that's why I call it citizens yet foreigners, because the reality is that Puerto Ricans are at once citizens of the United States and yet foreigners to the United States, in that they do come from a different country, and so it is that's the amazing dual personality, a dual reality that Puerto Ricans have. And so I try to explain a little bit of that. Most Americans look at Puerto Ricans as foreigners, even though Puerto Ricans have been trained in school to see themselves as American citizens.
Last comment on your investigation of Latinos in America, your book, Harvest of Empire. What surprised you most, or what you learned in investigating for this book?
I think what surprised me most was the consistency of the basic problem throughout all of the different Latino nations in terms of how people came here. And I was a lot more surprised as I delved deeper and deeper into the research, at how many Americans, especially businessmen, had traveled to Latin America in the 19th century, established huge fortunes, and in essence controlled some of those countries, far more in terms of numbers than I had ever imagined. For instance, there were thousands of people, of Americans, living in Nicaragua in the 1850s during the reign of William Walker as the president of Nicaragua. And they went there and took over the whole country.
Well, we will continue this conversation as we weave it through election year 2000. Juan's book is Harvest of Empire, History of Latinos in America. It's published by Viking. And again, he will be in San Francisco on Monday, in Texas on Tuesday and Wednesday. And we'll be talking to him there.
Los Angeles next Friday, right?
Los Angeles on Thursday and Friday?
Thursday and Friday, right.
And we have on our website where Juan will be, and that's www.democracynow.org or pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. If you'd like to email us, you can send us email at democracy@pacifica.org. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!